Wake Up with Bill Finch is live on WICC 600 and 95.9, the voice of Connecticut. Speak your mind. 203-333-9422.
Milford, Bridgeport area, we're so happy that Connoisseur Media gives us this hour to try to rebut some of the far-right agenda that's going on in the United States and speak with local leaders who are working hard to make our communities better, despite the insanity that's coming out of Washington. And just before we get into our show, we have a wonderful, a special guest today, Senator Sujata Godkar Wilcox, who represents Bridgeport, Trumbull, and Monroe in the state Senate. Before we get to Sujata, I just want to bring something to our listeners' attention, and I know the guest will have something to comment about this as well. As you know, President Trump and his minions have decided that there are only two biological sexes and that nothing other than a straight split between male and female would be allowed. And he's put it in terms of protecting females and femininity. I find it highly offensive, since I have family and friends who are members of the LGBTQIA plus community, who are living lives just as dedicated to our democracy, if not more so, than the general public. And for that, and for their choice of living arrangements and living choices and their courage, actually, to stand up and say, I'm going to authentically be who I am. Society's not going to tell me who I am. I'm going to assert myself and tell you who I am. Tremendous courage, on behalf of all the members of the LGBTQIA community. Navy has just come out. I have a fond place for the U.S. Navy in my life. Our father was a World War II veteran of the United States Navy, paid a significant price for his service. His ship was sunk at D-Day and nearly sunk at Okinawa. So we had fond memories of my departed father and the great heroism of him and his brothers gave to our country. None of them died to come back to the United States, by the way, and discriminate against minorities. When I asked my father why he fought in a war, he said, Billy, I fought in a war so you could vote. Now, of course, right-wing efforts in the red states are there actively trying to eliminate people's most primal right to vote for the leadership of this country and for our communities. Defending women from gender ideology, extremism, and restoring biological truth. It's a mouthful. It's an executive order. On the first day, this president decided the most important thing was for him to discriminate against the smallest, I would argue, the most defenseless minority in the country. And he seems to get his joy from going after the most unconnected politically minority in this country, the transgender community. He seems to really enjoy that whole you're fired mentality toward people who are struggling to assert themselves in this difficult time. It goes so far, the bros in Washington that are all around him, it goes so far as to eliminate funding for things that even sound like it could be transgender. The funniest example of that is there was transgenetic research being done on mice, transgenetic, meaning having to do with genetic research, nothing to do with transgender. But it sounded like transgender, so we're going to eliminate that too. That's the decision-making made in our great American democracy, where we vote with North Korea and Russia now, not with the democracies. We vote with the dictators. Now, just a little bit more on what the Navy is pushing. They say that medical and surgical and mental health constraints on individuals who have a current diagnosis or history of or exhibit symptoms consistent with gender dysphoria, which is in and of itself being debated, are incompatible with the high mental and physical standards necessary for military success. It says nothing to do whether they can do the job or not. It says nothing about whether they're qualified and good Navy personnel, sailors out there on the seas defending our country. This is how Hitler started. He started with the trade unionists, the socialists, the Jews. He started by getting them registered, getting them identified, in most cases self-identified, and then used that information as the fascism got worse and worse. So I've posted on one of my Facebook pages today that maybe we ought to start thinking about places we can hide members of the LGBTQIA plus community if the fascism progresses any further into roundups or into persecutions, which, of course, happens in authoritarian regimes where people have a very ideologically narrow definition of culture, and anything outside that culture is the enemy. So we're happy that we have the time every Sunday to talk about this and other issues, and I'm joined now by Senator Sujata Ghadkar Wilcox, whose name just rolls off my tongue now. You know, it just rolls off my tongue, and it used to be a difficult name to produce out of my mouth, and now I'm really good at it because I've gotten to know her. She is a battler. She is a constitutional lover. She is somebody who loves her family and her community and is fighting very hard. Welcome, Sujata, this morning to Wake Up.
Thank you so much, Bill. Thank you for having me. I'm glad we can, and I'm happy to come back whenever, you know, to have these conversations. There's so many issues to talk about today. So even in what you just said, there's so many threads to that. So I'm happy to be here to have that conversation.
Well, we're going to explore whatever issues you find the most important. And in just a minute, we'll be taking a break to pay some bills. The first segment of our show is always pretty quick. But I'm amazed every day that I see you at the Capitol, number one, at how hard you're working and how quickly you've assimilated into the process. But I also notice something that everybody seems to be walking around the Capitol, myself included, like it's a normal day. It's a normal session. And it's certainly anything but normal in the United States of America right now. We have a president who I identify more as my enemy than my president, and I'm sad to say that, but he just is defiling so many of the sacred underpinnings of our glorious democracy that it blows my mind that the majority of our fellow citizens were hoodwinked into this catastrophe that we now found ourselves in. But we'll come back in just a minute, and I want you to go through some of the high priorities, the great things you're doing for the city of Bridgeport, the towns of Trumbull and Monroe, with the funding issues that they're facing, and will only be getting worse with the cuts that are coming out of Washington. So just take a few minutes here for a break, and we'll be right back with Senator Sujata Ghadkar Wilcox from Bridgeport, Trumbull and Monroe.
It's time to Wake Up with Bill Finch, 203-333-9422. Only on WICC 600 and 95.9, the voice of Connecticut.
We've got a little bit of Bruce Springsteen in the background there, born in the USA. Sujata Ghadkar Wilcox is born on the 4th of July. What's more American than that? A woman from an immigrant background who's here making a tremendous contribution to our society, born on the 4th of July. I want to welcome you back to Wake Up. I was reading a book, I'm still in the middle of it, about the Wide Awakes. Have you read about the Wide Awakes?
No.
So the Wide Awakes were a vast political movement that people have forgotten about that started in 1860, and it was the youth who wore long black capes and had torchlight parades through the cities to support anti-slavery movements throughout the United States. And it started in Hartford, Connecticut, with male shopkeepers, because, of course, remember, ladies, you weren't allowed to vote. You were actually thought of as a possession, not a person, along with our African-American brothers and sisters. But the young men started this effort, and I hope that maybe as we learn more about the Wide Awakes starting in Hartford, Connecticut, we'll be able to not only wake up here on Sunday morning with a little bit of truth and veracity, but also we'll be able to encourage the youth to energize themselves like the Wide Awakes did to propel Abraham Lincoln into the White House. But listen, you're really busy on really important issues, especially for the needy in the city of Bridgeport. You recently were able to get $2.5 million in grant from the Community Investment Fund. Tell us a little bit about that and how you did it.
Let me take a step all the way back to, you know, I thought what you said was really interesting. How are we walking around the Capitol today, acting as if, you know, we're not so facing all these looming threats? And I think part of the answer is that we have to, because we already were facing a kind of, you know, crises in some levels, particularly for education around special education in the state. That's separate from, you know, that's before we even think of what additional impacts are going to come from continued federal cuts, because we had a number of agencies that were being supported by these federal ARPA funds, the American Rescue Act, and now those are That has ended. That was going to end regardless of who was going to be in office. And so we were already looking at a funding cliff that had to be filled by the state, and thinking about, again, you know, within our limited state budget, how do we now support the needs of all those organizations who are getting supplemental money that needs, that many of them require that funding to keep going. Many, you know, we're thinking of areas like education, special education, early education, you know, healthcare that already need support outside of that. And so there's so much work to be done, Bill. I think that's why it's, you know, we have to also focus on that. But I think you're right that we can't sort of ignore that this, we're in a time that's unprecedented. And so, you know, we have to do the work. So the work that's coming from the Community Investment Fund to make sure that organizations that are providing critical relief, particularly, you know, to communities that are the most in need, are getting that support. As the chair of special education, you know, I'm also a member of the education committee and then vice chair of higher education, because I think of education as a continuum. You know, we're seeing a crisis all the way throughout. You know, we have not invested properly in early education interventions, and we realize that that has had an impact on special education. We're at a complete crisis point in special education, which is why we even had that emergency funding for $40 million that we were able to get back, thankfully. That was just to fill in the gap for the budget for this year, because so many superintendents said, we spent all this money, we expected a certain amount back from the state, and that money has been reduced, but that's impacting our budget at the local level. You know, we're going to have to start cutting programs, we're going to have to start cutting teachers. Can you at least give us what we expected back? So that was what we did. That was an emergency act to say, we need to act now and get that back. And now we're looking into structuring special education so that it's not impacting budgets in a way that doesn't allow you know, districts to move forward, but also meets the needs of every student, because that's, of course, our primary goal. It's both our moral and statutory obligation, but that will require, you know, investments in how we restructure, thinking about what special education looks like going forward, investing in education. We also have issues in higher education. You know, if we're not funding our state universities and our community colleges at a level, you know, that will support sort of long-term sustainability. So this is just an education, you know, and so that's why we're doing that work, as you say, and I think it's really important. But I do, as a constitutional scholar, you know, hear your concerns, and I share them as well, because we have to start asking these questions about, you know, one, why we're acting in the way we're acting. And when, you know, whether you, so when people hear about executive actions and the cuts, if they agree with the cuts, or they're thinking about, oh, well, we do want a more efficient government. But the question is, why are, we all want a more efficient government. I would say that's the first answer. But two, you know, what is the consequence of acting in this way is what we have to talk about. You know, there is going to be an impact when you cut half an agency overnight. There's no way that's not going to have a fiscal impact. It's not like half the agency is sitting there doing nothing. Right. I'm sorry, I was talking about the Department of Education.
Yeah.
But there are cuts to so many agencies, right? When you freeze federal funding and you do it so abruptly, it's very disruptive, because we have institutions are slow to roll out things. That's just part of institutions. That's in Republican states and that's in Democratic states. You know, that's how institutions work. If you sort of suddenly cut things off, you won't see the impact because the process has been in place. You won't see the impact for a month or two, but in a month or two, it'll be chaos, you know, because there's no way that you can sustain that.
Just to point out the obvious, obviously millions of people in Connecticut benefit from what we're talking about. We've had arguments and debates over the last half century over what the social safety net should look like. We've decided 100 years ago or so on having a system of social security where we put our own money aside, Medicare for elderly to have medical treatment, and Medicaid for many others. And with the cost of medicine and medical care going up through the roof for years and years and years, we see tons and tons of new medical buildings going up all over the place. We're paying for that. And we've got a situation now where a third of Connecticut, listen, listeners, wake up, a third of Connecticut receives Medicaid benefits. That's how they're getting, that's how many of us are getting our health care in Connecticut. So if the federal government continues the tax cuts for the wealthy, and that's where the primary benefit is of the tax cuts that started under the first Trump administration. If they continue it, they're set to go out of service soon. But if they continue it, they need billions and billions of dollars to continue the tax cuts for the wealthiest among us. And they're going to get those billions of dollars by cutting the social safety net that on a bipartisan level, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. Now, the Republicans, when those programs first came in, voted against it, but they have come around to support it for decades.
Exactly. And I think now, we have to ask I think we have to be asking more difficult questions about what is the justification for that. So there is a justification given, right, that tax cuts for the wealthy actually trickle down and get reinvested. But it's been well established that that's not what happens. In fact, the last time we had these huge tax cuts, most of that money went back into, you know, buying back stocks. And so that did not go back to reinvest in the economy in the way that it was envisioned, right? And so that theory, that trickle-down theory of these tax cuts at the top actually will help everybody, those have been debunked. And I think that's the problem, is we're acting as if that rationale makes sense. So at that point, then you have to ask yourself, what is the purpose of that? It's not actually going back into the economy. We have evidence that that myth has been debunked. So you're really then just serving the interests of a few.
You're talking about an administration that doesn't get confused by facts. And, the darker side of that, too, Sujata, Senator, is many people have speculated that Musk and Trump want to drive the economy down because then they can buy failing companies forced down because of the recession that's coming. Musk, Bezos, Peter Thiel, they'll be there to buy at bargain basement prices and control even more of the economy. That's a doom and gloom way to look at it, but some people think that's what's going on.
Well, and the problem for me as a constitutional scholar, you know, is we're losing focus of what the foundation of our government is in the first place. The fact that we're even talking about how the executive can restructure government is the number one problem. And again, this is not a partisan issue because our Constitution starts with three important words, we the people. Article 1 is the legislature. Article 1 is the legislative branch because that is the most representative branch. That Congress is the one. Congress now can decide what to do with these agencies, but Congress is the one that has that responsibility because they are accountable to the public in a different way than the executive. And so the fact that we're having conversations about how the executive is going to start redirecting agencies of Congress is a huge, that's what is the constitutional crisis.
Sure.
And it's not a partisan, this is not a partisan issue because people agree when you like the executive. You're always happy with executive mandates when you agree with the mandate. But the question is, do you want somebody in opposition to your views, who's sitting in the executive role, to be able to have unlimited mandates? The answer for most people would be no. You know, so you have to think about this as a process, not about who's in office at the given moment and whether you like their policies. That's what concerns me. You know, that I find that the most disconcerting as a constitutional scholar is where is the accountability to the public?
You and I and your husband and many others were able to hear Harry Dunn speak at the Trumbull Democratic Town Committee fundraiser last Sunday, week ago today. And he talked about the fear that he had when Trump sent his thugs to the Capitol to try to overturn an election. I thought right then and there that there would be no way Trump could ever get elected after he tried to take the power away from the people. And again, you're right to point out, I mean, the founding fathers argued vociferously about three co-equal branches of government in order to forestall too much power in the hands of either one, especially
right.
The executive, I would argue. They were most feared of that because they were fighting against a monarch who was authoritarian. And, of course, Trump sees himself as a bit of a monarch and not interested in the Constitution. I doubt he's even ever read it. But it is a sad state of affairs. Now, tell me, even though we're going along sort of like with our heads in the ground at the Capitol, not seeing the you know what's going to hit the fan, and like you said, in about a month or two, the governor has put forward a budget. You had some comments on that budget. I'd like to explore that just a little bit because they say that the priorities and the values of the group of people are based on how they budget themselves and spend their money. I was really happy, not about everything in the speech, obviously, but really happy to hear about the endowment for early childhood education. As mayor, yes. We had over 90% of the children in Bridgeport. I don't believe those numbers have held, but we had over 90% of the children in early childhood education. And we know minority children come to pre-K having heard 1,000 words or so in English, and non-minority, mostly suburban children have heard 6,000 words. And that's the dichotomy that you start off on in trying to educate the haves and the have-nots in Connecticut. But I really think this governor has a commitment to trying to raise up poor children to be able to learn like those who have more advantage. What did you think about the endowment idea?
No, I absolutely like that idea. And I think for a long time, we have been talking about early intervention programs as having, and this is why I think we have to think about education as a continuum, because we think about all of these areas in a kind of siloed way. So early education is separate from education, and special education is separate from general education, and that's separate from like transitioning to higher education. But when we think of them all together, we realize that the way you support early education will have an impact on special education, because it turns out that students have been misidentified because they didn't have the early intervention programs that actually would have helped them and meet their needs in a way that the special education program did not. Special education then also impacts general education because of the resources that are shared between the classrooms. And so if we think of these things all as a continuum, you know, it's important to think about where we have to invest in the pipeline that will actually impact the entire pipeline. And I think you're absolutely right that the thing that we don't think about because we're so focused on K-12 education is early interventions. So, and how much can those early interventions, in fact, sure, on their own, yep, improve both special education and general education? And I know that, you know, superintendents, including, you know, our own Fran Rabinowitz, has really stressed this point, because I think early education interventions are absolutely, you know, critical. And there are other interventions that are critical,
take
too.
A quick break. We're going to come back to continue talking about the needs of this district and how hard you're fighting for it, especially the area of the children and education. We'll be back with State Senator Sujata Godkar-Wilcox after this break.
Join the conversation, 203-333-9422. Back to Wake Up with Bill Finch, live on WICC 600 and 95.9, the voice of Connecticut.
And welcome back to Wake Up, where our guest this morning is State Senator Sujata Godkar-Wilcox, part of a dynamic duo, a husband and wife team from Trumbull, Connecticut, who are both professors raising two beautiful children in the town, great town of Trumbull. And we're so happy that your family is a part of the decision-making process here in our towns and our cities, where local government and state government is really where the rubber hits the road. I saw that Bob Duff is very clever, the Senate pro tem. He's been doing a little video thing to Elon Musk every day. Here are the five things I did today, because as Musk famously, but of course thrown out of court, as all the other things are, required the federal employees to send to him their five accomplishments. So Bob does this all this time. We've talked about your accomplishments. We know that the Democrats and some Republicans are working very hard to maintain the status quo here in Connecticut. But, you know, and the courts have ruled, getting back to Washington's impact on us, the courts have ruled against the president in almost every instance, thanks to William Tong, our attorney general, and others who have been suing. The New York Times on Thursday debunked the savings that DOGE said they were accomplishing. Yeah. You saw that. They're just out and out lying about the money they save. But, you know, I go onto some of these sites, Senator, and the MAGA extremists believe what Musk is saying, and they don't read the New York Times. So I want to thank you for your having an open meeting with the community on the constitutional crisis. But how do we ramp it up? I know this really galls you to see our Constitution being disassembled by one authoritarian leader. How do we enforce the laws if he decides not to abide by the court rulings? And how do we return to the balance of government between three co-equal branches of government?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. And I think for me as a constitutional scholar, a very difficult question to answer at this time. I mean, I know that, you know, the courts are the ones that have been holding the line. And that has been critically important because we have to make sure that there is, that there's a branch of government that is, in fact, looking at the rule of law and actually applying rules in a nonpartisan way as they're meant to do. I don't think things will get as far in Congress either, as people may suspect, because the problem is when you have these kinds of, wide scale cuts, they're hitting everybody. You can't just hit one party over another, one region over another. And what's happening is, and this is why it's always better to have a representative branch making decisions, because those lawmakers in those areas where you're seeing the impact of those federal cuts, they're not likely to vote to support that in the future because that's impacting their own constituents. And you get a better sense of how widespread the impact is when it comes down to individual votes at the individual region. I think right now, we need to see the counter voice. This is alarming and unprecedented at a level that we've never seen. And I think people are asking,
since Jefferson
Davis,
where's
the visibility of the response? And I think that's where people, I think op-eds to say, look, the courts really are the ones that are saying this is unconstitutional and holding the line. There can be public support for the courts that are doing the right thing to make sure that other courts are doing that. I saw a couple of protests at the Capitol when we have session days. That opposition sort of indicates that, this is not working for a lot of people.
Well, let's hope public pressure has an impact, but what if he decides to just defy the courts? I mean, he is commander in chief. He controls the army that could round up transgender people, could round up dissidents, socialists, people he disagrees with.
Right. I mean, the courts do have some remedies. They are limited because, the way that our Constitution was structured was to create a kind of balance. And
we would have a traitor.
Right.
In the White
never
House.
Thought that's exactly. So that's the real struggle. I mean, they have an ability to hold people in contempt of court. For example, they have the ability as was the case during the Civil Rights era, to have the National Guard, for example. But of course, it's the executive that has to carry that out. So there are remedies that are kind of available for the court to ensure that, institutions are abiding by those protocols. I would say they're fairly limited. But remember, I mean, these actions are temporarily checked because a lot of these actions, closing these agencies, that's actually all under the purview of Congress.
Yeah.
So that's the reason the courts are sort of holding the line, is because you can't close down an agency that was created by Congress. That has to come from Congress. And I think, that's where people also need to start reaching out to their representatives to say, here is the impact on all of us, because it's Congress ultimately that's going to have to come in, and to continue, for example, shutting down an entire agency. That would be, that would be a huge problem. And of course, making that opposition clear, I think will sort of hold the line for Congress and then the courts as well, and that will be the check on the executive.
Well, listen, we could talk for hours with State Senator Sujata Godkar-Wilcox, but unfortunately we don't have hours. We have 1 hour. And one of the things the far right is doing is ginning up people in local communities to ban books. We saw it in Trumbull. We saw it in other cities and towns in Connecticut. I heard a DJ on this station say they aren't banning books. I was wondering what they were reading, because it's pretty much all over the place, and it's a disease and a scourge on our democracy. So we take the last 10 minutes of every show with Vic from Orange, who belongs to the Banned Book Club. And believe it or not, Sujata, you're not going to believe this, there are people who've tried to ban The Diary of a Young Girl by Anne Frank. I'll just leave it at that. I want to thank you so much. Please stay tuned and keep listening, because Vic from Orange is going to be on the line telling us why it's been banned and what to do to stop book banning. But we're going to take a brief break and be back after that. And we're going to have Sujata back again soon to talk about the progress we're making in Hartford at a future show. Thank you so much, State Senator Sujata Godkar-Wilcox. And we're taking
a
brief
pleasure.
Break. And we'll be right back after this message.
talking about what matters to you this morning. Wake up with Bill Finch. WICC 695.9, the voice of Connecticut.
Well, welcome back to Wake Up. Wake up about the far-right agenda. Wake up about Christian nationalism, what they're doing to take away your rights. Wake up about the crazy guy in Washington who's taking away funding from constitutionally approved, congressionally approved programs and shutting down programs and being stopped in court. We don't know what's going to happen if he defies the courts and defies the U.S. Supreme Court, if the court that seems bought and sold by the far right actually stands up as they have once already to Donald Trump. But nothing really surprises us anymore, right? There's a ratchet effect, and we just become numb to the absurdities, the disgusting behavior, the misogyny, the patriarchy. We just get disgusted and numb to the rancid behavior of the man some people refer to as their president. And how much more disgusting than the far-right Moms for Liberty trying to ban Anne Frank's diary. Now, let's just set it up real quick. Anne Frank hid behind secret panels in her father's factory with 8 people in 3 rooms, and they hid there for 3 years. They were found out by Nazi sympathizers who were paid a ransom to turn Jewish people in. And it was a couple of guilders, like a couple pieces of silver in the Bible. And these people, they just about made it to the end of the war in Holland when fascists turned them in and they were sent off to work camps and to concentration camps and to the mechanized, industrialized killing machines that totalitarian regimes often employ. Of course, the Nazis seem to have perfected it along with the Soviets and Pol Pot and Mao Zedong. But in this case, we're a democracy. You don't want people to read a young girl's diary that was fodder for educating everybody in the world about through the innocent eyes, the extremism that is authoritarianism. Vic, we're really happy to have you here. Tell us why the heck Anne Frank's diary could be considered graphic or pornographic, or somehow bannable.
Yeah. Good morning, Bill. And I apologize for my voice. Still getting over being sick.
You're on this show, despite the fact you're sick, and I understand you have a birthday in the family, so we're really thankful that you took the time to help our listeners understand there's nothing wrong with Anne Frank's diary, right?
No. You know, it's baffling. I was literally discussing this with my almost 10-year-old son this morning because he was like, I don't understand. Why would anybody not want you to read that? And I was like, well, you know, that's a great question from a 10-year-old. And it just blows my mind.
Smarter than the guy in the White House.
You know, every day I'm grateful that he's a little reader himself. You know, here's the thing. I read this book. It's hard to call it a book since it's a diary, you know, but I read this book when I was probably his age. I was young. I was always very interested in World War II history and the atrocities that happened there. So I read this book when I was quite young. One of the passages that is contested and kind of the reason that some districts are trying to ban this book or have tried to ban this book is a passage where the young Anne Frank, I believe she's about 13, 14 in this particular passage, she's trying to understand her body, and she describes what her body and her genitals look like in writing, right? In comparison to what she's heard the male body looks like. It is so incredibly innocent in that it's a normal experience. And honestly,
maybe not for the Christian nationalists. Maybe that explains something.
Maybe not, but it's also kind of astonishing that she's having this very common experience while living such an absolutely horrible and hard to understand and unfathomable situation, right? She's in hiding. She's in this annex above a factory, hidden behind a bookcase, and she's living the same experience that so many kids live out in, you know, the normal world.
And they hide in 3 rooms behind a mechanical bookshelf that was jerry-rigged so that no one would think there was anything behind there.
Yeah.
They aren't allowed to make any sounds during the workday because the factory is down below. Mr. Frank owned a factory for spices and for jellies. And
silent hours, right? Yeah. And then they
couldn't
have hours
the
where they can
during
climb.
Those hours. They had to wear socks only. They couldn't talk above a muffled whisper. They did it for 3 years, only to be turned over by a Nazi, a Dutch Nazi, for a few guilders.
And they had so many scares throughout their time there. But it's just, you know, you read this diary and it's such an authentic and heartbreaking experience. You know, Anne talks about everything from what they're getting on the little radio that they do have access to in terms of, you know, are the British basically going to win? And she talks about the food experience and how they're surviving for weeks and weeks at a time off rotten potatoes or rotten beans or moldy, old, spoiled, boiled lettuce. And how, you know, when they can get spoiled lettuce, that's almost a luxury because they don't have access to vegetables. And it's, you know, these are the experiences we need to understand. We need to know about, we need to learn about. And what better way to learn about it than through the eyes of a child?
So you read it at 10. Your son talked to you about it at 10. Is this okay for a 10-year-old or 11 or 12-year-old to read?
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, I think parents need to be understanding that questions may arise when they get to that one particular passage, and they may need to understand that kids are going to ask questions about the gas chambers and about the killings and the bombings. But there's no reason if a child can experience it that another child can't read about it.
Oh, how profound is that? Yeah, absolutely. If we try to end the world, and again, let's remind ourselves that in Europe, the Christian nationalists were the backbone of Hitler's regime. The less educated voters put him in. He never got a majority like the knucklehead we have. Got a slim majority of less than a point, I think it was. But still in all, got the majority. Hitler never got the majority, but it seems as though there are many of the early phases of the control. You know, you talk about the radio. It was illegal in Holland or any of the occupied nations to own a radio. Started out with just the Jews couldn't own one, and then it was everyone couldn't own one. So information control.
Because they didn't
control,
want access to the media.
Information
and
control.
And let's not pretend that these experiences aren't happening right now.
Yeah.
Look at Ukraine, and frankly, look at some of the immigrants in our country who are hiding and who have been pulled out of schools because they're afraid that they're going to get deported. This is happening right now, and if people believe that it's not, then that's incredibly naive and privileged for them to be able to think that.
You know, I read the book, Diary of a Young Girl, and then I also just finished Anne Frank Remembered by Mies Geese, who was the office manager for Mr. Frank at the factory.
Yep.
And she and her husband was part of the resistance, Jan, and Mies Geese was basically the one who protected, smuggled in food, and kept people away from the door, from the bookcase, and literally risked her own life multiple times to protect the Franks, only to lose them to a Nazi in Holland.
And Otto was the only survivor at the end of the war.
Imagine coming back after doing everything you could, living in three little rooms to keep your family together, losing them at the last minute, and then coming back home to try to run your factory, having lost your entire family and almost all of your friends.
This is Anne's legacy, right? Like, her goal in life, in her diary, she wrote she wanted to be a famous author someday, and she wanted her name to live on after she died. She wrote those words as a child.
Yeah.
And this is her legacy. To try and take that out of the world is just absolutely deplorable and disgraceful.
Well, let's hope that, you know, we never give up hope on anybody. And even those who are brainwashed into thinking that the MAGA way is the correct way and not seeing the hate and the disgust in their policies yet. Let's hope that maybe let's try to ban this book because the sales go up. And I think secretly the Christian nationalists all read the banned books.
There's a case right now about a former Meta employee, and the publisher has said, fine, keep trying to ban this book. We're publishing it. It's going to be out in the world, and you're helping drive up sales.
Well, Anne Frank Remembered was the title of the other book, and I think it's an appropriate way to end this show. Never forget those people who died and suffered for our freedoms. Never forget how dear democracy is and how dear our freedoms are, that we have to work for them every day. We have to read, we have to think, and we have to wake up every Sunday morning right here on WICC. Thank you for tuning in again. Thank you, Vic. As always, an emotional section of this show where we talk about the light shining from underneath that bushel basket that's been put there by bad people.